start by thanking the elders and those that are responsible for putting our plans for curriculum together. It's nice to be able to take a journey through the Man of Prophets. One of the things that was said at the beginning of this period was that, you know, it's something we all know and we've studied and whatnot, but we don't really often know as well as others. My first thought when I heard that was, oh, you know, I've read it and I know it. I think I can apply it. Boy, have I been opened up to all kinds of new things. Even this little 3-chapter book, equally wise in my opinion is the suggestion that different men take on responsibilities of teaching different books. And boy, when you jump into a book, it's you can get into the depth. So we'll do our best tonight. I also want to thank Justin for his background of these 7th century prophets. He talked all about the background of the Carchemish and the war in Thessalonica and things. And so we have a pretty good history about where we are in time. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time covering that. We'll spend a little bit. But I think this has been a really good study, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to present this information to you tonight. So, do you have the back screen on, too?
Oh, sorry, it should be. It was.
I can do it like this.
I'll get it going in a second here, Mike. So, it was on for a second, so I don't know what happened.
So, I'm thinking I just go right or left with this thing?
Yeah, right is forward, left is backward.
Okay. The first thing we have to get straight is, what camp are you in? Are you in the camp that says Habakkuk? This is the widely used pronunciation of the emphasis on the second syllable. This is the way most people say it. I guess it depends on what part of the country you're in. Or do you say Habakkuk? In this version, the emphasis is on the first syllable of the final case sound, soft into the kook part. And then, hubbub. So when you study this book, it starts here with who says it what way. And you get online and you'll hear one guy say it one way and one person say it another. Doesn't really matter what camp you're in, just know that there are many pronunciations. I remember teaching a class on, I think it was Colossians, and Tychicus or Tychicus. Oh, did we go round and round about the right pronunciation of those names? Is it East Coast or West Coast? I find that a little bit on it as well. Anyway, we're going to just jump into that while we start off with that that little introduction. So here we are in the time period of 7th century prophets. This is a section of timeline, Bible.study, Steve Rudd puts this together, if you know him and some of his work. So this is the time period involving the major prophet of the time, which of course is Jeremiah. And again, Justin covered a lot of this. Assuming both the teachers previously in this time period have covered this. It's the dying days of the Assyrian Empire. There's a lot of buildup of what's happening between the fall of Assyria and the rise of Babylon. Obviously the skirmish, if you want to call it, more like a war that happens. And Carchemish, Berenico, is defeated and pushed back all the way to Egypt. So we have a lot of historical and things going on that's affecting the emotions and the feelings and the fears of people, especially those that are in Judah. Notice in this particular information right here, we see that Joel is given a much later date here. There's two camps on that, 895, 835, I think it is. Some put Joel. The books that we've been studying have him much earlier. So there's definitely a debate there. I think the point of showing that and pointing that out is, you know, when we study these things, you'll get all kinds of information, and you need to kind of think through what you might find and where you might place some of these things. There are differences sometimes between the information that you can find online. And so, like I said, the books that we were provided put Joel at the later date. And so it's just, again, a difference and a distinction to point out. We find Nebuchadnezzar, of course, crushes Pharaoh Necho, and the Egyptians. Babylon would dominate in the Near East for the next 7 decades. And again, we've covered this. So the questions we want to, here's a structure of the book. Chapter 1 is about a burden. And Habakkuk complains, and it outlines the punishment of Judah. In chapter 2, he has a vision, he listens, and it outlines the punishment of Babylon and the methods of Babylon as well. Chapter 3 is a prayer, a very unique prayer with very unique characteristics. I'm interested to see what your thoughts are about that when we get. I want to try and open up conversation tonight, hopefully have some comments and thoughts from people. There's a lot to cover, but your input and our discussion on these things I think is important too. Power of God is demonstrated, and His sovereignty, a word that is not often understood well in the modern world, is the idea of sovereignty, especially the sovereignty of God. That's a big element. There are four prophecies in the book. What is a prophecy?
Foretelling.
So the prophet says something about something that history then later confirms that the prophet had foreknowledge of this information. Therefore, the information of the prophecy came from Holy Spirit, God. So these are very interesting things. He talks about the expansion of the Babylon Empire, the fall of Jerusalem, the fall of Babylon, new heaven, new earth. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more as we go on. So here's the question. This is where we really want to start. What is the message? We've all studied the book. It's three chapters. We're going to talk about this in detail. But just to kind of get the juices flowing tonight, what is the message of the book? Give me one thought, and we'll see how many we come out with. Ready? Go. Okay, if you look and make eye contact with me, I will call on you. Look down, stare away. Come on.
Confused by God's, what he thinks is tolerance of wickedness, why he hasn't acted on it.
Absolutely. He has this question. What else is happening?
I think ultimately it's hope.
It's very hopeful. What else?
Why is this happening?
Why is this happening? Okay, it's 2024, May, Asheville, North Carolina. Do you ever ask that question? Do you ever have those thoughts? What's unique about the Book of Habakkuk compared to some of the others we've talked about so far? What's unique about it? I asked this question in class a month or so ago when we were studying this.
God gives him an answer.
God gives him, he asks, and God answers.
What else? So I've heard it said that Habakkuk is the Job of the minor prophets. Mm-hmm. Because in the same way Job asked so many questions of God and God answered him.
Right.
So Habakkuk asks a lot of questions of God and God answers him.
They both needed a revelation. They were asking for a revelation. Now, we're not in the case of the Assyrian Empire waning, the Babylonian Empire, and all their brutality is rising. Eventually, knowing the destruction of Jerusalem is going to come at the hand of the Babylonians, it's going to affect in the life of Habakkuk. There's great fear. He's got great concerns. He has great prayers. But your prayers and your concerns and your questions can be no different. Hopefully, we can identify it with him. His message, though, his information comes from, he's not getting a revelation from God and sharing it to the people. Instead, what's he doing?
He's giving the people's perspective to God. Really.
And his own. He's giving both. It's a different kind of arrangement. Last week, we studied Zephaniah. Zephaniah was in the lineage of whom? This is a test review of last week's class. There we go. No, you can't answer. Come on!
The kings.
The kings. Specifically?
Hezekiah!
So we have his whole lineage, right? We have the whole, but we don't know anything really about that. He's a prophet. Now, we might get some insight into a little bit more about him as we get later on in this. It's also often referred to as a lament. What's a lament?
A song. Lamentation.
A song,
right? It's we're going to see, has a musical component to it and a poetry component. It's beyond, I don't know, without getting too philosophical, we've got a lot of stuff to go over. There's art in this world, Sistine Chapel, or, you know, anything Michelangelo would have done, anything any artist or other would have done. But then we have the incredible poetry and design and structure of books like this that take it into the area of possibly song and meter that is just beyond artistic beauty. It's another evidence, if you will, about the hand of God within it. It's fascinating if you want to study it. We could go off on a month for that, but we have to move forward. So the idea was just to kind of get some juices flowing what it's about. Judas' punishment and the doom of the Chaldeans, is it about that? Sure. We have God's power and sovereignty. Obviously, God's going to raise up the Babylonians, and he's going to use them for his purpose, ultimately bringing the Messiah and things of that sort. So it's definitely about that. And Habakkuk is sitting and wondering about these things and raising these thoughts even to the point of challenging God in some of these areas. Is it about ultimately repentance and reformation? Sure. Sure, it has that element to it too. But if you were to be asked a question that is, and again, it doesn't have to be one thing, it's all of these things. But the one thing that really hits out in this book is that the just shall live by faith. Did we not just spend 3 months in a little book in the New Testament that starts with the letter R that talks about faith? Okay, what book is that? Romans. We spent 3 months in there. What is the book of Romans about? Obviously lots of things, but it very much brings to mind the idea about faith and the righteousness of God and how we're to live in that faith. Now these things, these books like Habakkuk happened a long time ago, but they're still saying that the just shall live by faith. Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. For I am not ashamed, Paul says, of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation who believes, to the Jew first and also the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God has been revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man shall live by faith. Is that an original thought of Paul's? Do you think? Is there any such thing as an original thought? I mean, think about it. These New Testament writers and the gospel is very much built upon these very concepts of the righteous shall live by faith. So you're Habakkuk. You're living with the doom and gloom that's coming. We're going to go into the specifics of the chapter, but I want us to really start thinking about the big picture here and what it is. You are Habakkuk. You are living in this day and age, your day and age, in many ways no different. You see lots of things around you that you can't explain, and you might have the same question of God. Why? Why, God? Why do these people be the people who are in power? Why, God, is this person teaching my children in school? Why, God, is this the justice system that lives in the United States, or the political system, or anything else? Right? You can have the very same questions, and you can be traumatized by it to the point that it causes you a lack of faith and a lack of commitment to the ideas of God, the ideas of the Bible. But this book, God does answer his prayer, unlike he verbally may not answer yours directly, like we see in Habakkuk. But through the story of Habakkuk, and through this, you should be able to have the same thought and the same faith that you can come to God and say, I understand that even in your days of Habakkuk, the righteous shall live by faith. I am no different today how I live. Thoughts? Comments? Yes? Can a book like this is what I said earlier about, yeah, I knew all about the Old Testament and certainly the minor prophets. It's like, this is applicable to me today as it ever was. And that's the power of this. So thoughts?
I think all of us have questions about why certain things, God allows certain things. You know, as I mentioned, Job certainly had those questions. I did everything right.
Yeah.
And everything has been taken away from me. And my friends are telling me that it's because I'm wrong.
Right.
That doesn't make sense. And yet, my life is really a disaster by all that I can see. I just assume not be born. And we look around and we see, you know, the unrighteous prospering and the righteous oppressed. And we know that God is omnipotent. He's all-powerful. He's omniscient. He's all-knowing. There's only one God. There's only one true God. And he is perfect in his justice. And yet, all of these injustices are allowed to persist.
Yeah.
So,
why?
Make that make sense for me, God.
Yeah.
Tell me why that is.
Yeah.
And part of it is, well,
you think like a human, and my ways are not your ways. And I see at a level and a perspective that you can't even comprehend.
And in a time span much greater than yours.
And some people look at us and say, well, that's just blindness on the part. You know, you're just accepting that that answer from the God that you serve.
Right.
No, we really believe that, yeah, we don't understand everything, and it's going to work out how he wants it to work out.
Right.
And it's for his purposes.
Right.
And so you live by faith.
Right.
You continue doing what God wants you to do.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that throughout our lives we won't come to wrestle with these questions. You have the power providentially to solve this problem for me.
Yeah. We should be able to identify. That's the thing about Habakkuk, is that he could very much help us to identify with him. I always had the same feeling about Peter, for example. Peter actually got out of the boat and walked on the water. He actually did it. I get this thought that he's now on the water. He goes, whoa, look what I'm doing. And his faith for a second falters and he falls into the water. I mean, Peter whips out the sword and takes off Malchus's ear. He's ready to fight. No, get behind me. You know, he's the one who's sent to Cornelius. Why Peter, Jew among Jews, he's sent to Cornelius? And God says, well, is the story about Cornelius and his conversion, or is it about Peter and his understanding that the gospel's for all? These are very identifiable people. We should be able to see in these people our own lives.
I was just going to say, at the root of the answer to the question why,
right,
is we live in a fallen world.
Right.
That's the answer.
Yeah.
You know, God's in control.
Right.
But because of man's sin, we live in a fallen world. And bad stuff's going to happen all around us every day of the week.
So what type of person ought you to be? That's the question. And yeah.
At least just for the, I'm just going to say this just for the first section of Habakkuk right here. It also shows us, I mean, oftentimes we don't get the answers. I don't know that Job really ever got the answer he was looking for.
Well, that's the sovereignty
of God. But Habakkuk here gets his answer.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't like that answer.
Right.
So having the answers isn't always what it's cracked up to be.
Which is also real and something that we can identify with. So good. This is the idea. I wanted to really get your juices flowing and start thinking about this. So let's go deeper. So he asked the question, how long and why? God's response, I have a plan, and you won't believe it. Think about that. I mean, we can read through some of these things. Chapter 1, let's read chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, just to get us started. Who would like to read that for us? Jesse, can you read chapter 1, verses 1 through 4?
The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity, and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there art that raise up strife and contention. Therefore, the law is slacked, and the judgment doth not go forth, for the wicked do compass about the righteousness. Therefore, wrong judgment proceedeth.
There is corruption in his culture. He laments the conditions that are going on in Judah. Righteous Jews are suffering because of violent men. His candor is refreshing. He's just very honest about it, and he's open with God in his prayers. Does he really expect an answer? Well, you know, probably hard to expect that he's going to get a verbal answer from God or a vision. It seems hard to think that he would presuppose that would happen, but he gets one. But I just find it very interesting. You know, the righteous will suffer at the hands of violent men, even martyrs. I mean, the whole thing, I mean, There's a passage in Revelation chapter 6, and I won't have us go there, but Philip's been preaching, and I come to him a couple of times after these sermons, and I said, you know, when the fifth seal is broken, the Revelation talks about the martyrs. They're going to be affected when destruction comes upon the earth. And where are they supposed to go? They're supposed to go under the altar and wait. Put on a white robe and wait. The righteous will suffer. This is what happens. And he is in that camp, and he laments these kinds of things, seeing this is going to happen. When God uses Babylon to destroy Jerusalem and cause all the captivity that's going to come from it, the righteous will suffer. That is a real question he's honestly asking of God.
God responds with his answer. And his answer is about what? I have a plan and you won't believe it. So what is basically his answer? Pardon? Here comes Babylon. And what about Babylon? Right. I mean, the detail from which he goes into describe the terrible way in which this is going to happen. I have a work, he says, that I will do in your days. And he goes on to chapter 6 through 11 to describe the Chaldeans. Hasty nation, terrible and dreadful. Their horses are swifter than leopards. Cavalry comes from afar, etc. They all come for violence, verse 9. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather their captives. Sand, like sand, verse 10. They scoff at kings and princes. They deride every stronghold. Verse 11. Then his mind changes and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing his power to God. God knows who they are. And of course, this is what Habakkuk is dealing with, trying to understand how can that possibly be. So then we get to verse 12. Let's see here. Right, so we get to verse, so that's verses 5:1-3, I have a plan, you won't believe it. So the second complaint he asks, chapter 1, verses 12 through 17, and the first verse of chapter 2, he says, okay, but why the Chaldeans? You are holy. How can your holiness work with, so to speak, a people like this? And what are your thoughts on that? Are you not, he says, verse 12, from everlasting? My Holy One, we shall not die, O Lord. You have appointed them for judgment. O rock, you have marked them for correction. You are purer, a purer eyes than to behold evil. You can't look at wickedness. You can't do this stuff. Again, there's some candor here, is there not? Pretty interesting words that he has for God. What are your thoughts?
He's having a hard time understanding how the Holy God, and he, you know, mentions many of his attributes. How a holy God, who's so holy, can use these Chaldeans to do.
Right. What is it? Yeah, go ahead.
But you were going to talk about sovereignty. Maybe this is a definition of it.
Sure.
Sovereign over all nations. He'll use who he will in his way.
Supreme power and authority is a short definition of sovereignty. Supreme power and authority.
It's a repeated idea, but it's just that God has a plan, and men don't understand exactly what that plan is.
Right.
You know.
Right. And does it come across as being a little bit arrogant that you would even question it in the first place? I mean, in the beginning of this, he's struggling, and he's having some pretty stark words with God trying to understand this. Now, fortunately, we know the rest of the story, and he comes around to be a man of demonstrated faith. I'll stand on the ramparts and watch as they come over the mountain, he says, meaning the Babylonian army coming in to destroy Jerusalem, and I will do what you ask for, getting ahead, you know, writing these things down so others can hear, but I'm still struggling with this.
In Jeremiah 43:10, he says that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, is my servant. And he's my servant. So he's using the Babylonians for his own purposes.
Yeah, and I mean, these descriptions of things like, where did I see that? Verse 14, why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no rule? They take up all of them with a hook. Okay, this is this idea of hooking them in the lip and hooking them together and carry them off. Okay. Picture yourself being hooked through the lip and tied to the next guy, carried off. That's the definition of brutality, of ruthlessness and whatnot.
I also find it interesting in chapter 2, verse 1, depending on the translation you're using, the New American Standard says, I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved.
Right.
It's like he's questioning, how can God do this? But he's expecting to be reproved for this.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's passionate. There's a passion here that's being involved. He's under duress. He's under stress. And he's saying, you know, how can it come to this? Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of when Abraham was talking to God. He's like, I want to know the answer to my question, but I also know you're God and you have a reason.
Right. Yeah.
This is basically, he's complaining about the corruption of the land. He's wanting a solution. Well, I'm given the solution. It's like, whoa, whoa. Mm-hmm. That's a little extreme. A lot more extreme than I was thinking.
Well, there's a little bit of self-righteousness, or at least nation righteousness, going on. Sure. Look, we're so much better than they are. Yeah. How can you do this to us? And they don't have God's perspective of who they are.
And of course, they struggle with that throughout. I mean, we have the Ark. We're undefeatable. Is that a word? Undefeatable? Indefeatable? We can't be defeated. So anyway, yeah, he's got a lot of that. And think of chapter 2, verse 1. I will stand my watch, he says, and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I'm corrected, to Zachary's point. Say, so chapter 2, we get into God's response. And this, really, chapter 2 through verse 20, God's response is the just shall live by faith. Through chapter 2, verse 20, he talks about the pride of the Babylonians. Their five woes, really, pride, greed, and lust of their plunderer. Verses 9 through 11, those that are secure in these ideas are exposed to the sovereignty, the wrath, or the ability and the power of God, the authority of God. Oppressive tactics of their prosperity. I mean, their strength is in their prosperity, their debauchery, their idolatry. You know, this idea of inventing their own moral standards, you know, praising themselves and deifying their own military strength and their military powers. I mean, they're lost in their minds. They're lost in their hearts. And Habakkuk is having a hard time understanding how you can use that God for this other purpose. But what's happening here in this idea? I mean, we talk about the captivity of the Babylonian captivity, and we see Daniel and the restoration and all the promises and prophecies that come forward. We know the rest of the story. God has a plan. And what is that plan through all of this cleansing and through all of this discipline? Define the remnant. The righteous are those who walk and live by faith. Through this turmoil, through these changes, through these struggles, and it is no more applicable today than it's ever been. Today is equal to any other, even though we see the drama of the world history being exposed here and told to us here. It's no different. Make this personal, because it is you. You are struggling in the same way every day, and you can have the same thoughts in your prayers and in your heart and in your idea and understanding that even, we'll talk about it in a moment as time permits, but there's a lot of New Testament writers that directly tap into this. All right, so the Lord answered and said, verse 2, write a vision, make a plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. The vision is set for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak and will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. What does that sound like to you? Why these words at this point? The Lord answered him and said, write a vision. What does writing something down from God do? And what benefit does it have?
You can look at it again.
Share it. Lots of people can know it. What do you know about God?
What the Word reveals.
What's been revealed? That's the thing. Man searched long into these things. Angels and prophets long to know these things. But God's revealed them in a mystery, New Testament writers say. This mystery is this idea of the Gentiles being added, the whole plan of God, and through the Messiah, this whole plan. God has a plan, and it's out there. And so he's saying in this way, write it down, but in the end it will speak. Wait for it. When you pray, be patient. Whose strong suit is patience? Raise your hand. Go ahead.
I don't have time for
this. I don't have time for this. I mean, there's compassion in God's words here, is there not? Not only does he answer his prayer, but he says, tells him that I have a plan. And I think that's love. There's compassion in that. And when we see his conversion, Habakkuk's at least conversion in his thoughts and his hearts to his prayer and his praise of God in chapter 3, we see that that does provide. That's what he's asking for. God's answer to his prayer is, know these things, that these things will trouble us. It's the same thing that happens, in my view, in Revelation, when the martyrs are discussed in that way, is that it's going to be destruction when good and evil fight at the end of times, and the righteous will suffer. We suffer in this world today because of its broken and fallen nature, but we should live by faith, no different than him. Yes, sir.
Second Peter 3, with the scoffers who are saying, where is the promise of this coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation, and so on. There's a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, no. I mean, the thoughts ring through
the New Testament writers in the same way, because this is a common problem to man. It always has been a common challenge that we have. And the answer is the same. That's another thing. We're no different from him in his time. Yes, sir.
Interesting aspect to this that, you know, throughout most of the Old Testament up to this point, the people have asked for something and God's given it to them. Like right then, we want different food. He gave them manna. We want a king. He gave them a king. We want this. We want that. He gave them that. Now God is saying, okay, that's you messed everything I gave you up. So now you're just waiting for me. Now you're waiting for me to finish and say what I want. And that would. You know, from Habakkuk's position, you can totally understand him, because that's, you know, pretty much the first time God said that. And not only that, he's using people who don't have the promise to do it, you know.
Nice. Excellent. See, good comments. Nice job. You guys are thinking.
That's a good comment, Jesse. Thank you. Yes.
It also shows God's mercy, because he's like, you're writing this down, mm-hmm. so there's a chance for people to run.
Right.
And to be informed, as we all are. So we talked about chapter 2, write it down. The encouragement he talks about in verse 3, you know, at the appointed time, wait for it, and God's schedule is right on time. God's schedule is not your schedule, but God's schedule is on time, and we need to see that through the faith. Here's another passage, and I just don't think we can afford not to take the time. This is Hebrews chapter 10, 36 through 39. And you can see in the beginning, you know, in verses 37 and 38, it's quoting directly Habakkuk 2:4. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. For yet in very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. What is the main idea of the book of Hebrews? What was the problem that they were having? Joe, you know this answer. Main problem the Hebrews were having.
The main problem they were having was understanding the, number one, they didn't remember the, you know, the whole history, their history.
Right.
They couldn't connect Jesus to Melchizedek.
Right.
They couldn't connect the priesthood, that there had been a change in the law.
Right. And they're living as Christians in a Jewish community, and they're being pulled back into Judaism. And God,
the Holy Spirit comes to them through the Hebrew writer and says, we aren't those who shrink back. We press forward. There's a lot of things that are going to happen in the world around you. But the ideas of Habakkuk in this context are being injected into this context in the book of Hebrews. It gets right into chapter 11, which is commonly referred to as what?
Hall of Faith.
The heroes of what? Faith. Right? We aren't those who shrink back. We aren't those who fall. Even though these disciplines and these challenges are going to come, we press forward through the writings and the thoughts of men like, through the Holy Spirit, of men like Habakkuk. My righteous one shall live by faith. That is a common theme throughout these. Okay? If you read the context of 19 all the way through verse 39 of Hebrews at later, you'll get the whole point. I mean, it's really salient when you can think about Habakkuk and all that we're talking about, and then read Hebrews 10, 19 through 39. It blows you away. And if we have time at the end, maybe we can do it. I just want to press on. So we did that. All right, this is where we geek out, officially noted by the geek sign right there. Okay. So chapter 3 begins with the prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, on Shigionoth. Shigionoth. Okay, you can't come across a verse like that and say on Shigionoth and just brush it by it. What does that mean? Well, geek man looked into this a little bit. On Shigionoth means with impassioned triumph, with rapidity, with abrupt changes of tune. It refers to a lyrical poem that was composed under what? Strong emotions, and is accompanied by music that fits the theme. Habakkuk is stating that his song, his prayer, should be sung in the manner of the Shigenoth. Okay. Does that add anything to it? It's in the text. Does that add anything to it? Take away from it? Does it give us some sort of sense of the context a little bit?
Well, the depth of his feeling is...
The depth of his feeling is definitely being expressed, no doubt. So, more geek time here. This is free. Three key locations, Taman, Mount Paran, and the heavens. Three manifestations of God's power, the natural phenomenon, the judgment on the nations, the salvation of his people. There's three responses. Fear and trembling, verse 16, reflects the prophet's human reaction. Patient waiting shows his resolve to trust in God's timing. Joy and strength conveys his ultimate faith and reliance on God. The Shigenoth style underscores the profound emotional journey of the prophet. Further, as we get to the end of the book, and a lot of commentators, at the end of verse 19, it says, to the chief musician with my stringed instruments. So the Levitical singers, the singers in the court, would be given instruction in this psalm to sing it in a particular style. So if you've got Shakespeare, for example, Shakespeare writes da-dum, 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 da-dum. And we learned all that in like English class. It's called iambic pentameter, right? It's a form of poetry. You've got other types of poetry. You've got sonnets. You know, you've got all kinds of things. You have musical scores, Beethoven's and Mozart's and of the world, that write in their musical scores. But in this context, it's trying to communicate, best understanding, it's trying to communicate that this impassioned response, this prayer as a lament, is to be repeated. It's to be communicated and sung in this way, with this emotion, with this power, to understand the importance of this point. Do you follow? It's beyond fascinating, and we don't have time to go into it, and it doesn't necessarily change our concepts of salvation or not, okay? It's something that's in there. It's beautiful. We often look at the Old Testament writers in the poetry of the Old Testament, and we talk about parallelism, right? These ideas where you put up something and then you say it again to repeat it. You got antithetical, which it says something is black, but if you know something is white. There's various forms of this poetry. This is part of this prayer in chapter 3, and I just think it's fascinating. Thoughts, comments, personal study. I just wanted to introduce this thought to you. If you wanted to study it a little bit more, there's a lot of information about there. It's in the text, and I didn't want to go by it, and I certainly didn't want one of you to ask me about it. Hey, Mike, what is Shigenoth? So I don't know that I fully know, but I preempted your questions at least. Okay, moving on. A place, apparently. How'd I do? Okay, so this outlines God's plan for the future and for the end of time. So there's three petitions in the prayer. The first one is to revive your work. So we see in chapter 3, verse 2, O Lord, I have heard your speech and was afraid. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. What work would that be? What is God's work? Prior to Habakkuk, what has God done in the world?
Well, his promises to Abraham are really his work from the Jewish perspective, and I think from our perspective as well.
Do we know the story at this point of Sinai to Israel?
Sure.
Right? God's done a lot. His people have a history. They have a culture. Habakkuk is saying, God, did you forget who we are? Your people? You can't bring these Babylonians in here. Look who we are. So he's saying, revive your work. Now, God's given him a future vision, but he's also saying, revive your work. And he says, remember the mighty works in the midst of the years. He's talking about it being in his day. Revive your work. In other words, you know, we want to connect with you. We want to be your people again, but we're seeing the Babylonian army come over the mountain, and we're gonna suffer. Don't know what the future might be. So there's some concern.
Because they destroyed Assyria.
Right.
But, you know, I guess the nation can get to that point where it takes a really strong medicine to get back.
Sure.
In this case, a captivity. Well, yeah.
It was captivity. I mean, that's the thing about books like Daniel, where, and even, you know, I mean, in Daniel, you know, the righteousness of he and his friends is shown, their strength and their courage. And I always say, you know, how did those three young men survive that? Well, they had good families, they had good parents, they had good teaching. Something gave them the strength and courage to be able to stand up to Nebuchadnezzar with all that we've known. Yet, throughout them, God's with them. You know, you get to Daniel chapter 9 and he's praying for the nation, you know? We did wrong and whatnot. And so anyway, okay, that's me to get going. Help me understand, he says, in the midst of the years, make it known. That's another element of this prayer. Make it known to the other people, he says. It says, O Lord, revive your work in the midst of years. In the midst of the years, make it known. And then he also says to be merciful. You know, destruction was upon them. Great wrath was coming. Compassion will sustain the people through this. This is part of his prayer. And the details of the prayer we can't really get a whole lot into, but I did want to talk about, I mean, there's lots of beautiful language in here and things that talk about, you know, this whole idea of recounting their history. There's references to what God did, taking them out of captivity, out of bondage in Egypt, and all the way through their 40 years in the wilderness and to the taking of the promised land and whatnot. And he gets to the end of this. And again, this is this image that I shared with you many months ago. It's always been fascinating to me, this idea of how he says at the end that the Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hind's feet and makes me walk on my high places. This is the New American Standard Version I generally read out of the New King James, where it says deer. This idea of hind's feet. What image does that portray to you? Now that we've kind of fastly summarized through what's going on here, what image does that give you? He's saying, God, be my strength, he is my strength, and he has made my feet like the feet of a deer so that I can walk on high places. In the context of everything we talked about, what does that image say to you? It should be a powerful thought.
Sure-footedness.
Sure. What else?
Confidence. I mean, that's sure-footedness, but...
And what's more dramatic than that? How did they get there in the first place?
Sure-footedness.
No fear. I mean, we're talking about throughout his fear and being afraid. You know, I'm sorry, the 45 minutes or so don't give us justice to get into a lot of the details. I really wanted to get the conversation going, and you guys did great tonight. Thank you for helping. We can identify with Habakkuk. We can identify with the journey that he went through. And, you know, he brings his own history to bear in the earlier verses of chapter 3 about reminding them. He changes in verse 8, and he says, O Lord, you were displeased with the rivers. Was your anger against the rivers? Was your wrath against the sea that you rode in your horses, your chariots of salvation? Your bow is made quite ready. Oaths were sworn over your arrows. He kind of makes it, you know, I think it's Proverbs 8-ish, where it talks about the personification of wisdom. You know, I, wisdom, was with God in the beginning. You know, when the language changes to say, like, I, wisdom, and it puts it in that first-person sense, it's kind of intimate. I think we see the same thing here. Habakkuk has demonstrated real candor, if you will, a real intimacy with his prayer with God, and a responsive heart. Did his heart not respond to the things that he heard? You have to believe that his prayers here is sincere. And we have it in Galatians, we have it in Romans, we have it in Hebrews, where these New Testament writers use the exact words in chapter 2, verse 4, the just shall live by faith. And books like Romans are based upon the idea because it's a universal thought. Yes? All right. Thank you very much.